Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Veterans Day sale, save 40% on the Sleep Number Special Edition smart bed. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turn Out of Punk Splits. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with not one, but two former guests of this show that may or may not know each other, but one thing that will be had will be an amazing conversation. And today on the show, these are two people that definitely know each other from Guns N' Roses and 10 Minute Warning and the Veins and the Fastbacks and the Silly Killers and I'm leaving out tons more. Duff McKagan and from the great DOA, Joey Keithley, and also a politician, Burnaby council person, and a legend. I don't mean to diminish it by just giving them one band, but my God, what a band. They are both multiple appearance havers on Turn Out of Punk and are returning today because they are collaborating and playing some shows together, and I will talk about all of that in a second. But first, you can find me over at Instagram or Twitter at LeffordDamian. My brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show. Does an Instagram page for this podcast, a Facebook page for this podcast, and you can find those at Turn Out of Punk on those platforms. You can also find Turn Out of Punk on YouTube or TikTok as well. And that is that. Support this show by telling all your friends about it. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have one last show coming up on the 19th. In Toronto. And so come on out. If you're around, come and see that show. I think there's tickets still available. And we'll see you there. We've put out a bunch of records this year. If you want to get the Turn Out of Punk edition of the album Another Day, you can hit up Emissions Records here in Toronto. They have a website, an Instagram page. You can find all that stuff there. You can get that now because it's not going to be available forever. There's a new record. Fucked Up has a brand new record called Someday. And you can check that out where you purchase your albums. I don't think it's for sale yet on physical format. I mean, like where you go to listen to records for streaming. It's probably on YouTube. It's definitely on all those other streaming services. And that is that. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, returning to the show are Joey Keithley and Duff McKagan. Two legends, Pacific Northwest punk rock legends, worldwide legends. Joey, of course, with his band DOA, the titular first hardcore band. And Duff McKagan played in this little band called Guns N' Roses. And we will talk extensively about both in a second. But before you go off and listen to this thing, these guys have a brand new record together. And it's a 7-inch, which will be available exclusively on this upcoming Duff McKagan tour. It's going to be My Name is Bob that Joey Keithley's on, as well as also on the B-side, or I guess the A-side, All Turning Loose featuring the great Lee Ving. Lee Ving will also be opening a bunch of these dates on this tour. And Joey, as we talk about on this show, spoiler, will be making a special appearance at the Seattle stop of Duff's tour. You can find out all the dates for this thing at duffmckagan.com. We'll also have a link to it in the description for the show for tickets and whatnot. And it starts today. If you're listening to this thing, the day it drops, tonight in Boston, November the 4th, get out and see Duff McKagan and Lee Ving. My God, what a double bill. And I could ramble on forever and talk about this episode, but I'm not. I'm not going to do that to you. So go and see Duff. Pick up this brand new single, only available on this tour. Also, he's got a new song with Steve Jones doing Heroes by Bowie that you can hear online. You can hear the other two songs online as well. There's also a live Duff McKagan record that's coming out on Record Store Day. And on the Joey Keithley side of things, there is a brand new DOA tribute record. We talk about it a little bit on the show. 14 different bands covering DOA. And I think it speaks to the influence of the band when you see the artists that are on this thing. Everyone from Rancid to the Descendants, to the Circle Jerks, to Voivod, to Duff doing two songs on it as well. You can order this thing over at the Great Sudden Death. .com. It's just sudden death.com. The great is implied. And you will find that there's a bunch of different versions of it, some different color variations and whatnot. And pick up a copy of Hardcore 81, the titular first hardcore record ever by DOA. Also available now from suddendeath.com. In terms of shows, I should have said Joey is also playing the Portland date with Duff solo acoustic. But there is going to be no more DOA shows announced so far this year, but I'm sure there'll be some touring next year. And Joey's got to do that good work as a council person, city councilor, I should say. This is all on display in Scott Crawford's highly anticipated documentary, Something Better Change, which has premiered as of October 19th and has a second screening coming up on November 15th at the Sound Unseen Film Festival in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So check out that documentary and see the world that Joey lives in, because it is a incredible. I'm in awe of how much work this guy is able to kind of do and be that force, be that inspiration. And I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Duff McKagan and Joey Keithley on Turned Out of Punk Splits. Joey, Duff, Joey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be back.
Thanks for having us, man.
Well, this is, you know, you're two guys I associate with each other so much, because Duff, I think every time I've spoken to you, we've ended up talking about Joey at some point. And I know he's a figure that looms pretty large in your musical journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Well, and it's also both of your fourth time being punished by me on the record.
That's okay. I'm a sucker for punishment there, Damon.
Well, Joey, you've been on the show four times. Duff, yeah. I interviewed you one time, which we will not name. It's for people to find. The other time you were on the show officially. And before those appearances, you and me did an episode of Danko Jones's podcast that I really consider kind of the beginning of this podcast. So you loom large in my life, too, outside of music stuff. I mean, just in a punishing you capacity.
Where were we? We were in Australia. Is that correct?
Yeah, we were in Australia. We were backstage, and Danko Jones, our mutual friend, both of us being former members of the Black Coffee Brigade, and I think both still members in good standing with Black Coffee Brigade. Danko asked me to sit down, and I just went loose on you about Joey, Seattle punk, and it was kind of proof of concept that I could have a podcast where I could just talk to someone about their punk rock journey. And you're someone that's always repped it. And I think in terms of DOA, someone that's always made a point of bringing up DOA's importance, because, and this is my Canadian inferiority complex talking a little bit here, but I think DOA kind of gets overlooked sometimes in the history books in terms of their importance.
Yeah. I mean, I know Joey's sitting right there, so I don't mean to be talking about you while you're right here, but my observations about DOA are, They were the first band to tour, the first North American punk band before Black Flag, before Husker Du. DOA had made the list of places, like phone numbers. And they would actually just go out and call places and go play. Correct me if I'm wrong, Joey. And then they were the very first one, and Black Flag came after about, but it was like 2 years later, a year and a half later, then DOA was already doing it. And Husker Du got the, you know, got the phone list after that, and bands started to do it. And I mean, our first GNR tour up the West Coast tour, we only ended up playing one show in Seattle, but it was off of the list. We booked the tour going up through Sacramento. Starting in Seattle, come down Portland, Eugene, DOA, Joey was at that kid's house in the basement that we got the number from you guys.
Right.
Black Flag or whoever. It was that kid's basement, his mom's house. It was a place to play. And then it was Sacramento, San Francisco, LA. But we only, of course, ended up making one show in Seattle because we had to hitchhike. Our car broke down. But DOA had a van. You guys had a thing, and you, right? You had a whole thing going.
Yeah, we had a weird van, Rampage, Randy Rampage, rest his soul, bought. And it was an old hunk of crap, right? And we had a similar experience. Our very first road trip, where I started to meet all these people and accumulate this list and circulate around, we went down to Mabuhay Gardens in San Francisco. We had no vehicle, so I took a train. Chuck and Randy took a Greyhound bus, and Brad, our guitar player at the time, hitchhiked down the I-5 with his left ball in his hand, no case, with his stomach. So,
amazing.
Like, you're talking like 1,000 miles, like, yeah, I don't know how many. And yeah. And he showed up like 5 minutes before the show, right? It was just kind of like barely made it. But when we started this list, right, they started like, because we were like adventurous, and we just, you know, I would like take the Disco Sucks single and I'd mail to people. I'd go like, hi, we're a punk rock band from Canada. Can we come and play in your town? And then about a month later, I get a letter back. Go, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And that's how we kind of started that, right? And just end up. And then the list got bigger. Then I really started circulating, comparing notes with my buddy Chuck Dukowski from Black Flag.
Yeah.
He was like really on top of it for those guys, right? So it was a mutual thing. And they're great buddies and, you know, one of the all-time great bands, obviously, yeah. Right? So, Duff's completely right. Like, if you went around North America, besides the big centers, you know, where the Clash or the Ramones or the Dead Kennedys, they will fly in.
Right.
But most of the time, in smaller towns, the first punk rock band they would see would be DOA, you know, because we would just go, like, there'd be no money. We'd like, oh, hey, we got $50. That's pretty good, right? You know, like, that should be enough gas to the next town, right? So, you know.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you brought up the fact, like, with GNR, that you guys are kind of taking from that playbook. And I think that's the thing about GNR in the early days, from putting out your own records to kind of booking your own tours. It's kind of like, it's almost like the taking the lessons that you had learned from punk rock and applying it to kind of this new thing that would eventually become something huge. But like, it is still kind of like, we're going to have to do this ourselves to make this happen.
And it wasn't too far removed time-wise from, you know, okay, so I started going to gigs in 79, DOA being, you know, and so 80, 81, started my own bands, you know, Fastbacks and Farts and 10 Minute Warning and all that stuff. A million, The Living, you know, I was in so many bands trying to find the right combination of things. And meanwhile, going to all the best shows you could ever imagine, you know, and DOA being at the center of many of those great, great shows. Opening for DOA was the hugest, like, get. You know, oh my God, I'm on the same bill as DOA. Staying at the DOA house up in Vancouver eventually, like, oh my God, staying in, under the same roof. And, you know, Zippy being like, you know, this ring. There's all these characters, you know, that we could go deep into. I don't know if other people would know who they are, but this cast of characters that really, it was such a group of people that really helped each other out. And that was the key back then. Like, hey, you need an amp? you couldn't get your amp across the border, no problem. DOA would like, or somebody at the DOA house would help you out, you know, like totally. And that happened up and down the coast, really. And Seattle was very supportive. Vancouver is very supportive. The Modernettes people, everybody, you know. And so flash forward just, you know, another year or two, and Guns N' Roses formed in LA. I moved, and Izzy and Axl had moved from Indiana. You know, like people had moved there to make something happen. And we did that. And how else are you going to do it but do it yourself? That's what we learned for punk rock, you know, putting your own singles together, gluing the thing, you know, all the whole thing. Having Kurt Block do the artwork, you know, in our case, you know, and he still does the artwork, Kurt Block. He's the best.
When was the first, like, had you heard of DOA before you saw them? Like, was the legend something that preceded them, or was it that early on that you were like catching it off guard?
You saw the flyers up on the telephone pole. So in Seattle, when I was a little too young, it was bands playing at the Bird or some place, you know, whoa, what is that? And it was DOA. It was the Lude. You'd see these things up on the telephone poles, like, who's that, you know? And finally, I don't know. Kurt and I tried to dial it down to what the first punk gig I went to. There was the Cheaters, his band too, you know?
And a single.
Yeah. So there was all these cool bands, and I don't know what the actual first punk show I went to. It may have very well been DOA. And I don't know what place. We tried to figure it out, and we couldn't figure it out. But it was 79 sometime, and I saw DOA, I don't know how many times. I saw Hardcore 81, which was, you know, went up, made the pilgrimage, and it was epic, you know.
One of my favorite records I've ever gotten to acquire is, I got it, now I've misplaced it, of course, but it's a copy of World War III, but like signed to the guys from The Enemy. And it's like signed all over, and it's got a little Enemy sticker. I can't believe I was just like looking at it before I got on air with you guys. And I'm like, oh, I want to show you guys. Oh, here it is. Too excited about this. But it's like signed by everyone in the band from like the second lineup to the guys in The Enemy. And I love it because it is like sort of this, I don't know, it's like there's a geographical distance between the two scenes, but there is this sort of like forever linking of the two worlds to me between Vancouver and Seattle. And I know politically and geographically different places, but there is sort of like this sort of cultural shared thing that goes throughout, you know, like Nico Case being from Seattle and joining a band in Vancouver later on. Like there is sort of this cross-pollination that kind of continues right from the get-go, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was just an obvious thing. Seattle's a big place, so you'd usually start the tour there. You know, we get across the border somehow. And I think that show that you're talking about, but might have been that you couldn't get into the one at the Bird, because I think that was The Enemy, The Lude, DOA, and that was our first stop in Seattle. And I remember dealing with the Lude's manager and trying to get paid, which they eventually did. There was a bit of commotion with that. I won't get into all the details, but he eventually got paid, like you usually do, right? But yeah, we started playing down there a lot because it was just like made sense. And the clubs kept changing. There was always a different club. Like it wasn't like some towns, okay, I played this same place 10 times in a row, right? Yeah. You know, sometimes that you play the Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto, that's great. But some other times you're like, wow, we're back in this dump again. We're really going nowhere, right? Boy, maybe we'll just hang it up here, right? So, yeah. But Seattle had a great connection. The other thing we share together is the weather. It's like we get a little bit more snow than those guys, but we should get the same wet weather in the winter times. It's like it's been bringing like crap up here for the last 3 weeks, right? So I don't know about you there, Duff.
I'm looking outside to some rain right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So you kind of get that's part of the bonding between two cities, you know.
But you know, you know what's impressive to me, like it like last night was Halloween, right? And these kids, they don't care if it's raining.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Northwest mentality. It reminds me, you know, like you see people out walking, there's no umbrellas. There's no, like, they just, you go into the rain. And you start at a very young age. And I saw these little kids dressed as, you know, princesses and little, you know, whatever he was. And then, yeah, they, you know, the teenagers come a little later and nobody's got an umbrella. They're just like in the rain doing it.
Yeah, I get to see when lots of times been down in California and the guys going like, oh, Joe, I don't know how the attendance will be tonight because it might rain. I go, I'm a Canadian. I'll go to a show when there's ice and snow. What is wrong with these people?
Yeah.
I feel like also stylistically, both scenes have constant mirrors of each other. Like as artier scenes are popping up in one place, they're also popping up in the other place. And there's compilations that, of course, because I guess the radio signals would go across the border, right? So there's like, you know, like college stations that you could hear in both places. And like, you know, 5440, the first place that they're obviously 5440 Duff being Canadian legends and music, but the first place they're on a compilation is a Seattle compilation.
Right.
The guys from Pansy Division's band before they did Pansy Division. Like there's a, an interesting sort of mimic. And then I guess also with the negative stuff too, which Duff, you talked about last time, what drove you away from Seattle in terms of drug problems, like both are really affected by heroin at the same time. It seems like it both of them kind of have to deal with that.
83. It's really, I mean, I noticed that Joey, like really coming in at 83. I don't know what that was, that big, like deluge of heroin coming into the Northwest, in our case, the Northwest. But I'm going to back up a second, make no mistake about it, because I still feel like the little brother. Vancouver had a much more robust scene than Seattle. Make no mistake. Like what Joey said, we played different places in Seattle. There was no place to play. There was the Bird, and then there was a big, there was a big lapse. You'd have to rent union halls and stuff and do it undercover because, you know, they don't want to know there's a punk rock show going on there. So you'd have to disguise what you're renting it for. You'd have to get a cop, you know, like a rent a cop and throw the shows. I knew people were throwing these shows and then you eventually start throwing them yourself. But DOA would have to, I mean, that's the adventure. They would like, they don't know what they're playing at. It's some, some kid is suddenly a promoter, you know, and he's set Kyle Nixon or something, you know, he's 17 years old, kind of knows what's going on, puts it together, tries to pay the bands and, you know, but we were, you guys, Vancouver had, it was a much more international scene. I saw, you know, some bands who couldn't get in the US, like the Professionals, Steve Jones and Paul Cook couldn't get in the US. Right. They played up in Vancouver, you know, because it was still the British of Columbia was still much more pronounced, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. It's a funny thing. I mean, just going back to touching on the drug deluge, which we're still really suffering from up here, it's gotten much, much worse. But Vancouver's nickname used to be like Terminal City because it's the end of the line and there's no stop in between there and Hawaii and Japan type thing. And a lot of people came here. It was the end of the line because a lot of people, and Duff, you remember the Smiling Buddha, right? That was like, Maine and Hastings, which is the easily the roughest corner in all of Canada now. It was in those days. And we were teenagers. We take the bus from our little suburban town. Well, let's go hang out with me and Hastings. This should be fun, right? Yeah. You know, but it was rough. You know, because we just said we'd unload the van. We keep two guys in the alley and let one guy carry all the gear in, right? So one guy could get overwhelmed. All of a sudden, like, you know, a guitar or like a tom-tom's gone or like an amp head or something. Probably not an amp head, probably too heavy to run off, right? But pretty rough, though. And as I say, it's gotten worse, right? So
I've seen it.
Yeah. Same thing when I go to Portland now. Like Portland, to me, is a really fun city. I really like it. But, like the homeless population and the people that are living in desperation has expanded tenfold in the last 5-10 years, I would estimate, you know.
Yeah.
You
know. Was it heroin when you got down? Obviously, now it's the super opioids. But, like, when you first got down, when you're visiting, was it heroin back then in that neighborhood? Or was it just sort of, like, other drugs at that point?
A combo. I mean, people were doing speed, people were doing heroin, you know, the a mix. Now it's like the jumbo combo or everything, right? And people would actually probably have a better chance of life if it was heroin as opposed to fentanyl, you know. But neither are good, obviously, right? So, like, you know.
No, there's definitely an argument that has been made. I think Dana Larson currently has kind of been making this argument that if we had had legal drugs and access to these sort of legal drugs that were the softer version of these, like opium instead of heroin even, and like coca leaves instead of cocaine, that maybe there wouldn't have been this sort of escalation as people have looked for these sorts of highs in other places. Well, it's a controversial opinion, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's all the whole thing with like a safe drug supply and somewhere to do these drugs. I mean, the first solution is not to do drugs, but obviously not everybody is in that mental state. So we've got to try and help the people that are, you know, are having these problems. And it's usually from some trauma earlier in their life, right? So that was, we just had an election up here in BC, and that was actually a massive election issue with both the right wing and left wing party wrestling back and forth with neither of them with like great solutions, you know.
Right. There was a thing here in Seattle. I mean, we could talk about it because he brings up Hastings and Maine and the Smiling Buddha and that area. And this is 1980, you know, 1981, 1979. It was gnarly. Like, luckily, yeah. What was his name? Simon, the bald guy with the he was like a longshoreman. He had tattooed and he was kind of a big, tough dude.
Oh, and Simon Wild. That'd be
Simon Wild. Simon
yeah,
Wild.
Yeah.
Luckily, there was him. Like he would like, I remember being a kid and he, yeah. Something happened in the alley and suddenly he was there like Superman, like, aha, it's kind of the toughest corner, you know? And he was a punker, thank God.
Yeah.
But the drugs coming in and seeing that for me, like I really laid waste to my scene. You saw it kind of outside of the scene, then it came into the punk rock scene. And years later, Seattle did this thing. Semi-recently, downtown, like 10 years ago, this three block straight area, open drug use. Okay. And I was like, 10 years ago, I was going, okay, maybe that'll work. Like some European capitals do that. And maybe that's a forward thinking thing. And maybe that'll work and you can contain where it's at. And it exploded. So to your point of like, legalizing some drugs like opium and stuff. This thing, it's open drug use downtown Seattle, did not work. It got ugly and they've had to shut it all down. They've had to put lights. It just became this crime riddled, like Wild West sort of thing. And that's not going to work because, you know, then my wife can't walk from the, you know, our gym downtown down to Target, you know, cause it goes through that area and it's too gnarly. It got too gnarly. I'm using my wife as an example. You know?
No, and I totally get what you're saying because, like, I struggle with this not like on a you know, not to make it about me, but like on a selfish personal level with my friends that are caught in use problems right now with these drugs. Where I want to be the cool friend and I want to be judgment free, and obviously I'm not going to judge them, and I want to be like harm reduction about it. But at the same time, like you watch friends that are killing themselves, and you're like. And in some cases, I've lost these friends, and I wish I had been like, stop fucking doing this. Like, as cool as I want to be, you're killing yourself. And there's like got to be a middle ground, I guess, between accountability and harm reduction, because pure harm reduction, it's hard to hold yourself accountable when you're feeling really good.
Right? Yeah, it's a big problem. I mean, one thing we've talked about up here, is that like having a big facility with a 6-7-step program where you kick people off the street. You try and help them clean up, get reconnecting with their friends, maybe get interested in something they could go and make a living with, and they come out the other side as a reform. Now, obviously some people that will never work and they're still gonna stay outside for the rest of their lives with their shopping cart underneath a freeway or like wherever, like, you know, you can't, but, you know, until there's a concerted effort by the main governments, like the big governments and the help from cities, this won't stop. It's going to continue on for years and years, you know. And, you know, here in BC, we're spending millions of dollars a day trying to fight this as not not working at all, right? You know, right. Anyway, so you don't say.
And it's so ingrained in our culture, particularly like this part of culture, you know, like our biggest stars have died because of opioid use. Like, and I promise we'll get back to punk in a second, but like, you know, we talk about Prince, we talk about Michael Jackson on some level. And then Duff, you talked about running into him on the plane ride home that night in the book, but Kurt Cobain. And I know, you know, DOA, they opened for you guys in 88 in Seattle with Coffin Break at that show. And it's, so it's like, here's our biggest rock icons and pop icons that have all succumbed to this thing, you know,
like, I mean, there's so many, you just nicked the very top of the iceberg, you know, Lane Staley and, you know, how many Seattle Lane and Tarnell and Scott Weiland and Thunders. And yeah, I mean, it's just, the list is too long. But, you know, me being on inside of that world for a minute, you know, like, there I go. I pull a geographical and I move from Seattle to L.A. thinking there'll be no drugs here. And there'll be no, you know, of course, it's everywhere. And I somehow got myself stuck into addiction. It's not where I planned to go. It's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the best band in the world. You know, like, that's it. And I got myself into trouble. And then I was on the other side of that line, you know, and you can really see, like, I could see, oh yeah, this is, you can't get out of this, you know, like, and I thought everybody was doing drugs and everybody was drinking, and the mailman and everything. And being on the other side of that thing, you can see how, I don't know how anybody would have got to me. People tried, you know, including my family and my, you know, band and friends and stuff. And I just kind of thought they didn't know what they're talking about, you know? So I can see when I go downtown or go someplace, I know, I understand that other side. Like, I can't go up to somebody, hey, brother, let's just get off of drugs. You know, it's not going to work. I don't know what the solution is. There is a lot of mental, like, a lot of mental health issues downtown. Yeah. Like, they just arrested a guy for stabbing somebody. I had to find him. He's schizophrenic, you know, like, he shouldn't be out on the street. There should be some place where he can be to maybe get, you know, get some help with that, you know, instead of just out on the street, like, screaming at the world, stabbing people, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like punk, it's been brought up, like, Nicole Panter, who used to manage the Germs from Decline of Western Civilization fame, when she was on the show, she talked about how punk is a place where people with trauma, will inflict that trauma on other people so they can inflict that trauma on other people. And it feels like punk is a place that if we were, you know, quote unquote, normal functioning people, we'd be just able to fit into normal society and listen to whatever bullshit was on the radio. Like, we're all drawn to this because there's something in us that doesn't necessarily fit into society in varying degrees. So of course, this is a place where drugs and in some case predators would find a hunting ground, because there's a lot of people here that are looking to medicate and self-medicate, like you brought up earlier, Joey.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but to me, the main part of punk was there's a lot more to it than, not to change the subject, but I think to me, punk rock was always about doing things, getting things done, kindness. And, you know, but because it was like such an interesting thing, it attracted people, I call them bon vivants, so to speak, from all like, oh, what is this punk rock thing? I'll go see it. And then either, like, you know, that people were listening to experimental music, punk rock. We used to put on shows with reggae bands. It was a really diverse crowd would come to their early shows in Vancouver. And, you know, and of course, people fell into this trap that we've been talking about. And, you know, but I don't find that as the biggest emphasis in punk rock anymore, because at first it was like, you know, when Sid Vicious died, people went, see, that punk rock is just a stupid nihilistic form of music. Look, here's the leader of the movement, and he's dead. And I go, like, a lot of people just didn't understand that punk rock is a really great, creative thing that has helped a lot of people.
100%. And I feel like that's...
Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking about drugs, but really had so little, you know, we're talking... it came in and wiped out a couple of things for a minute there. And some people kept doing drugs and doing it. But when I got into punk rock, it was like this open area. When I got introduced to people and like people turning me on to the Stooges and MC5 and here's T-Rex and check this out and the Ruts and check all of this stuff out, you know, Stiff Little Fingers and wow, you know, I played that record at home. I lived with my mom. She started crying. She's like, these poor boys. I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, this, you know, they're singing about the Troubles in Ireland. I'm like, what is the Troubles? It opened my mind to
right. Political
things and all of this stuff. And it was, you could talk to other people and there was intellectuals and you learned a lot about history and things that were going on at the time. And you could, you know, in my case, I had like really bad cystic acne. Nobody stared at me, you know. There was weirdos and there was things, but it was a safe place for everybody to go, borrow equipment, learn new chords, you know, learn how to play drums, watch Chuck Biscuits fucking play drums. Like, oh my God, this is the best drummer in the world, you know? And you would just like, the learning curve was huge. And it was, you know, years later, of course, some things came in like the drugs and all that stuff, but the punk rock spirit, like that I learned from in 79 and 80, like do it yourself, kind of three chords and a truthful message in the lyric, you know, learn through DOA and the Clash. And, you know, that still stands so heavily in my life. And a lot of people I know that came up at that time, that's what stands the heaviest thing, not the drugs, not to anything else. The welcoming kind, what you say, Joey, all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that you just learned a lot from it, like, you know, a lot of creativity, like so many of those great bands, like you mentioned, and just like with my first experience with a punk rock show was the Ramones came to Vancouver in 78, and they played the Commodore Ballroom, holds about 1,100 people.
Yeah,
they had sold two tickets a day before the show, so my old friend Drew, who ran the place. You know, like, who desperate to sell beer and alcohol, make his money back, said, okay, it's a free show. So we went, so about 100 of us that heard punk rock went down to Southern Ramones. There's about 102 people there. They get the Lute open, and then Ramones played the first album, Start Finish, and they left. And the 100 of us looked at each other and like, okay, so that's what punk rock actually is, right? Because we've seen little blurbs on TV, like the, you know, the Damn, the Pistols, Clash, whatever. So those guys... okay, that's the textbook right there. We just got like a lesson how to do this stuff. And I know those people I met there became lifelong friends, like the 100 of us who were just drawn into this like weird, and everybody criticized the Ramones when they started, like, oh, the lyrics are dumb. They don't make any sense. I go, that's bullshit, because the lyrics were adventurous. They just weren't, they were not predictable like most rock bands had become in the 70s, right? Those guys came out. Yeah. Anyways, I'm kind of getting off the point. But,
No, you're not.
No, absolutely. Okay. And I feel like that's the thing about this is it gave like everyone permission who found it to kind of go out there and create their own world. And I think, like you said, Duff, it's a super positive thing and it's amazing, you know, what this thing was. And even though, you know, the Nerves had done their own DIY tour before DOA did theirs, what you did, DOA did, was put a glamour on it and say that this is important, the way we do things, and kind of like shine a spotlight on the means of production as well as the amazing actual cultural output. And I think that is the difference between punk and hardcore. And that's that division where all of a sudden it was like, it wasn't, there's not this competitive nature that you find with a lot of punk bands with each other, like Ugly and Vile Tones famously had beef in Toronto. And like, there's always, you know, here you are showing up in town and being like to these bands like Black Flag, like, here's how we do it. Here's a list of phone numbers. It's not a competition. We're in this together. And I think that's what makes this thing so amazing, is that there's something bigger than success involved in us being all together. And that's a continuum, you know, and I, not to dwell in the darkness, but like you guys, I don't want it to seem like this heroin thing is over. The darkness of opioids is over, because my good friend who I would sing Guns N' Roses songs too when we were on tour passed away because of this bullshit a couple years ago. So it's like, it is not a huge specter, but it is still a specter that haunts this thing.
Yeah. And no doubt.
And as amazing as it is, there is still this sort of like thing, a part of it. But to transition back to more pleasant things to talk about, the Lude, the Lude is definitely a band that comes up constantly between the two of you. And a fascinating band, of course, Kurt Vanderhoof from Metal Church later on was in this band. They are a band that, Joey, you talked about them getting chased out of Vancouver by bikers.
Right, that was crazy.
Yeah, but they also seem like a band that would have been incredibly fun. Did you get to see them live, Duff?
I saw the Lude live, yeah.
Was it before they took off, or was it still in Seattle before they moved to SF?
I think they were kind of straddling that thing. I think it might have been, they might have went down to San Francisco. It's all lore. You know, I didn't know them. They were older than me. They're Lude. They have posters up on, you know, telephone poles. I don't, they're as big as Led Zeppelin is. You know, and so is DOA. You know, like all these bands were, I saw Led Zeppelin at the Kingdome. I got, you know, I had a paper out. I could buy the tickets, $10, you know. And then you hear about DOA and the Clash and the Lude, and they're, to me, I'm 12 and 13, they're as big as Led Zeppelin. They're from, you know, Vancouver, BC. I mean, that's a different country, you know? So they're as big. Yeah. They didn't fly in on an airplane like Led Zeppelin did and play on the stage that was 100 yards away. But that's how you wanted Led Zeppelin to be, like untouchable, right? Flying back away on their airplane. DOA was, I think they drove in on a van, you know, in a van. And, whoa, you know, they, but they're still as big as that. And the Lude, to your point, the Lude, I think the lore was they'd moved to San Francisco, tried it out. They were coming back to Seattle to play a show. I think they were straddling it. So I had the, you know, that first, the single.
Kill Yourself.
Kill
Yourself.
Yeah, she had a baby. She went. I had
this trash can baby.
Trash can baby.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
But that's, you bring up a lot of interesting points, because I think that's the break, once again, between punk and hardcore, is like the Lude are definitely a capital P punk band, Kill Yourself, and they presenting themselves like New York Dolls-style rock stars, whereas DOA is like dressing like that you would always dress, showing up, and like you're saying, they're showing up in a van, and they're also like, as godly as they are, they're sort of these like gods amongst people, where they're approachable and telling you how you yourself can become a god.
Yeah, I mean, when the first couple times I saw them, I was terrified. They were DOA, man. They were not terrified because they were coming off the stage and coming at you, like Ron Reyes did when Black Flag.
Oh yeah.
He was just angry for a minute there, Ron Reyes, the nicest guy in the world.
DOA
was, they were, because they were so, they took the music part so seriously. The Lude, you could tell like there was like some humor, and there was like sort of a sickness in there too. Like, where are these guys from? Like, why are they talking about a trash can baby? Well, that's dark, you know. DOA was kind of shedding light, you know, I think, and knowledge and some things. So I did see the Lude. Yes, I saw the Lude.
When you were on the show the first time, actually, you talked about going from Kiss worship to DOA worship, and how this sort of like, there was a natural sense to the way it worked, in the way that these bands are completely incompatible with one another, but both are, have this aura. I could see how like it would make sense to go from one to the other, even though it doesn't make no sense.
So for me, Kiss was Kiss Alive 1. I didn't have the records before that. I had Kiss Alive 1. And so you go to a Firehouse, down, 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 or whatever, right? And then you go to DOA, down, 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 down. It was a easy move, you know?
Right.
Chord structure, what, you know, that's all I'm listening to. I'm, as a kid, I don't know how big the bands are. I'm listening to chord structures and delivery, and DOA was more approachable. Like, maybe I could play that in a couple of years. Kiss was too big. They were like, the crowds were, you could hear Kiss Alive One. It was like, it's too big. I can't, that's too far to get. Not that DOA was easier to get to musically or any of that stuff. It was just, it was more mine, you know? Like, I had seven older brothers and sisters, and you want something of your own. And suddenly I had something of my own. Kiss, anybody could go find Kiss, you know? DOA, I searched for and I found, and they were mine.
Which I guess as a kid getting into music, because Guns N' Roses was what got my brother and I into rock music, our own music. Like, that was our first band we fell in love with as like little kids. And I think that was the thing that made you guys different than a lot of the other bands coming around that time, is that it was sort of like the DOA presentation versus the Kiss presentation, where, you know, it seemed like, even though it was like cool clothes and but like it was clothes that you guys would dress in normally. Like, you guys didn't seem like you were dressed for stage all the time.
No, no, I had a pair of pants.
Yeah.
I remember that. Like, my daughters always ask me, like, Dad, you always wear the same pants, all those early pants. That was my pair of pants, you know? Like, wasn't until we went to play the Marquee in London, which was like super far out. We didn't have any money. Make no mistake, we had nothing, but we played three shows at the Marquee in London, July of 87. And there was, we stayed in Kensington at like this apartment, because we were there for 10 days, 12 days. And there was a place in the train, in the tube station that had stretch jeans, black stretch jeans. My God, what? 10 pounds. And so I bought, you know, 10 pounds was like, back then, like $20, that was a, you eat or you get the, you know, you eat for a few days or you get the pair of pants, which is going to be. So I had to get a new pair. So I finally got a new pair of pants. But from 80, you know, you just don't, you got a job, you got your band, you're just paying rent, and you got to have a phone and you got to eat. So your job's kind of taking care of that, maybe. You, and then you got your band and you're doing that. You're doing two-a-day rehearsals and you're, you know, you're used to it. You can't afford to get a pair of pants or go to a restaurant and eat. You go to that, you know, that happy hour that's got the little hot dogs and stuff. You buy, you know, one beer and you can eat, and you eat all you can, and that'll last you a couple of days. But pants, yeah. So we wore the same thing. Yeah, it was approachable because that's what we wore on stage, was our clothes. That was it, you know.
Well, it's funny too, because like, you know, like I think the big thing that's always made up is that there's sort of this hard distinction between punk and hardcore and sort of the Sunset Strip glam scene that you guys get lumped into. And obviously it's a completely different thing, but like the reality is, like, be it Vince Neil and the Wigglers or Nikki Sixx playing in the Tupperwares up in Seattle, or Ricky Rackman being involved in hardcore. They're with the LA bands, they're sort of like this thing, but they all get really glammy and they all get really, you know, they present themselves differently. Whereas Guns N' Roses never did. And I feel like that's like a weird DOA influence, or at least that's how I've perceived it in more modern times. And then also obviously the other guys being from the Midwest, like there is sort of this like anti Pacific Northwest, Midwest glam thing that's kind of going on.
Yeah, I mean, we our influences were the punk rock stuff, you know, the DOAs, but Motorhead and Axl and Izzy brought, you know, from the Midwest, Nazareth, and that was a stripped down. If you get into Nazareth deep, like Miss Misery and all that stuff, it's just very dry, killer approach to rock and roll, you know, and that no fancy clothes and none of that stuff. So it was really like the bands we loved, the Dolls and all that stuff, Johnny Thunders and for sure, but it was more like the glam thing was, I mean, it was all right. It was like, okay, this is coming back. That's fine. It wasn't our thing, you know. There were some bands, and there were some bands where it got too fancy for their own good, you know, with the glam thing. And you could see it right away, you know. Yeah. So
Well, I think you're understating Izzy's punk resume there, because we've talked about this before, but Joey can attest, because were you still playing in the Fastbacks in 82? Because DOA, The Living, and the Fastbacks all played a show together in Seattle on June 19th, 1982.
Okay, yeah.
Monroe's?
Monroe's,
yes.
Yeah, Dan Spallis, yeah. It was about 110 degrees out, or inside the halls, it was 120.
Were you playing drums in the Fastbacks at that point?
No, at that point, they had Richard in the band. I'd left, I guess I was like 15 or 16, and formed The Living, went to guitar.
So you're playing in The Living, right, at that point?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, then less than 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks the day later in Los Angeles at the opening of the Galaxy with China White and the Vandals, Joey, you also played with a band, DOA played, with called The Atoms, featuring Izzy Stradlin on drums.
Wow. Okay. I wasn't aware.
Yes. He was in The Atoms. That's correct. He
yes.
was.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. That I did not know. So that was in 82?
In 82 on the same tour. So 2 weeks apart, you're playing with two future members of Guns N' Roses in two completely different bands.
Oh, good factoid.
Yeah.
That's really good research. Wow. That's really cool. And I had no idea at all.
Right? Well, and I haven't talked to Izzy about this ever, but not to put on him. So maybe DOA is also an influence on Izzy when you guys are forming GNR on some level too, because that would have been a sick lineup to see DOA on in 82.
Yes. Yes. Izzy. Yeah. I'm not understating Izzy's punk rock influence because he and I, we first met and got to know each other. You know, you talk about the bands you're in and all that stuff. And he was talking about this band he was in and called the Naughty Women. And I'm like, wait, I played a gig with you guys. I think I was in the Fastbacks and it might've been a DOA show, but he was playing drums. I said, did you guys dress up as women? Because we did. I said, man, we played a gig together at the Cathay de Grand.
Wow.
In Hollywood in 1980, two or three or whatever. And Joey, that might have been, do you remember taking the Fastbacks on tour down to California?
Yeah, vaguely. God, what year though?
Yeah, yeah. So I roadied for them. I just wanted to go on a trip. I think I'd broken up with my girlfriend, so I roadied for them.
Yeah.
And Sacramento. And I think maybe the Cathay de Grand, maybe that was just a Fastbacks on their own gig. I'm not sure. But
it could have been. Yeah, I remember the Cathay de Grand. That was not a bad place to play.
It's the first time I saw the Lads. That's the first time I saw like a punk rock. I'm like, what have they got? What are these? What's that about? Oh, they're a punk rock gang. I'm like, a what? Yeah, it's a punk rock gang down here in L.A., the Lads. You remember that? The Lads?
Yeah. No, I just remember the Circle One guys, right? So
Yeah,
which was a whole nother story, right? So
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
L.A. Death Squad, which was, I believe they also had an offshoot group called the Dogpatch Winos, which Smelly, the drummer from NoFX, was a part of.
Wow. Okay, that was an offshoot, huh?
Yeah,
okay.
They had an offshoot crew. They had like a couple other, which I imagine it's interesting because Guns N' Roses is coming to Los Angeles at a time when that gang stuff has kind of hit a tipping point and the shows have gotten so violent. There's almost this sort of mass exodus, it seems, to other scenes, be it like the Paisley Underground stuff or the kind of like the, I guess, country punk stuff.
Right, there's a lot of that. Yeah.
And you guys are kind of coming in at that time too. Did you guys ever have to deal with kind of the gang stuff in Los Angeles around then?
So when we first started, by the way, we a lot of our gigs were opening for Texan Horseheads, and we were in like at the Music Machine, like all these like cowpunk scene. We played with a lot of those bands.
Right.
That's the gigs we got. And then we opened a show downtown at the LA street scene, and we were supposed to play with Fear, and that there was a kind of a riot and the cops came through and that stage got canceled. So they moved us over to a different stage opening for Social Distortion. And we were a band that just couldn't put a, you know, where does this band belong? We didn't belong anywhere. We could open for anybody and we would, but that the some skinhead gang came to that show, and they were just roaming downtown, the street scene thing. And they were up front for us, spitting and throwing stuff. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you guys are new punkers who have no idea what you're doing. You know, punk rock's about inclusiveness and being cool to each other. And this ain't punk rock. You know, I'm playing my gig and thinking all this stuff. And I'm spitting back, you know, because I'm pissed. I'm like, you guys are ruining punk rock. You know, that's what's going through my mind. You guys are damaging the thing that that our, you know, older brothers put forth for us.
It's interesting how that also winds up having, you know, I'm sure not to outweigh the violence and the damage it causes, but it also has interesting effects creatively, because out of that, it causes all people to kind of reject that scene and build new scenes.
Hey, Joey, did you read the book? It's called Discos Out, Murders In.
No, I haven't read.
It's fascinating. Okay. It's about all that Circle One and all that stuff. And, one of the guys wrote it. He went to prison. He killed somebody, and he got sober and kind of found himself. And really good writer. Discos Out, Murders In.
Well, I'm gonna take a look for it. Yeah.
And you would have been playing like a lot of those shows, not that you guys were bringing this sort of violence, but like just because of coincidentally, when you're playing in LA, being the titular first hardcore band as hardcore is taking over punk, I'm sure you would have seen some of these crazy violent shows or been at least hearing about it at that time.
Joey.
Yeah. We had one show down in Lawndale at a place called Froggies, and Wimpy, my old bass player, rest his soul. As one of those things, as an afternoon show, and all these guys showed up with not much hair in their head, shall we say. Brian said, oh, make sure we get paid before we get played. Paid before we play. I said, no, I'll collect my afterwards. Always get paid. It was always my job. And he goes, no, I got bad feeling about this one. And it turned out that these guys came to steal bars, and they smashed all the urinals to bits, right? So there's like flooding everywhere. They're dancing on the floor, wrecking everybody, beating people up. And it was like fucking chaos. Then they won the fight. And we had the 17-year-old kid, like selling merch for us. A guy picked the skinhead, picked up a chair, threw this metal chair at the kid, and he ducked in time to get out of the way because he threw it at the DOA merch. So then, needless to say, I didn't get paid. And then the guy made the signal at me, like, I'm going to come out and get you. Like, he had a gun. And I just thought, typical Canadian. I come to a gunfight armed with a hockey stick, right? And I just thought, okay, this is terrible. So I finally sought the guy out. We talked it out because I thought he's going to come harass me every time I show up in L.A. But my favorite story about dealing with these guys, we were in Denver, and they had about 400 or 500 kids, and a really rough point area in Denver called Five Points. And these skinheads were at his old theater, the orchestra pit, and then there was a theater seat up there. So people were trying to dance around, and these skinheads were all elbowing each other. And finally, I just stopped the show halfway through the set. And I said, look, let's just why don't you guys take it easy? We got to talk this out. And of course, what they always did, they would send forth their biggest guy, right? That's always the strategy. Okay, go kill this guy, right? Like, what's he talking about? And I reached down to shake the guy's hand. And he had this, like, the white beater shirt on. And somehow I snagged his shirt. And all of a sudden, I ripped the shirt off his chest. And I held it up in the air. And all the kids that weren't skinheads, all the punk rockers, went like, ah. And they went and attacked these guys and drove them out of the thing, right? So I'm holding the guy's shirt up, and he's looking at me like, I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, oh, you probably are. But that was the signal, and they never came back.
Yeah, that seems to be something that kind of happens. You hear about, like, Chris Hanna from Propagandhi was on the podcast one time and talked about how Winnipeg had a huge Nazi skinhead problem till the BFGs, the bunch of fucking goofs, a Toronto band.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for Duff's edification.
Thank you.
They showed up and beat the shit out of all the Nazis. And then they were like, oh, we can just beat the shit out of these guys. There's more of us. These kids are ruining our shows. Why don't we just say fuck you? So sometimes the impact of those sorts of gestures can be, obviously, as illustrated by you in Denver, massive.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. I had another guy, another confrontation with down in Dallas in the I try and get some sleep on our little old school bus on the street, and they're having this like Nazi rally on the sidewalk. These foreigners are taking our jobs, blah, blah, blah. And I'm listening like, oh my God. So I called them out in the middle of the show, and we were playing Fuck You, so which you would always dedicate to idiots. So we dedicate to them. So again, they sent forth their biggest guy, and he come up and he tried to jam my mic down through my teeth. And I ducked and I took my old SG I've had forever and I broke it across his head. And then it was on. Okay, yeah. You come down here. And the four of us, we all picked up like mic stands and cymbal stands. No, you come up here type thing. And we're going like, eventually a couple of bouncers went like, oh, there's trouble. And they threw these guys out and they broke our window in the bus on the way out for fun. Right. So,
Yeah. I saw that starting to happen. Like, I don't know, what was it? Like 83, I think. Late 83. And it was really like the jock kids from out in the suburbs, mm-hmm. would cut their hair and they were, you know, playing football or whatever. And they thought, oh, coming down to punk rock, they're the slam dancer, they're fighting. This is a free place to come and just fight. And like, no, you missed the point. That's not what this is. Like when slam dancing came, people were taking care of each other, you know, mm-hmm. picking each other up. And this became a whole like other thing. And I just remember this ain't for me, man. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's also part of it. Like you kind of hit a point where you almost age out of the zeitgeist in a certain way, because like another generation is going to come along. And obviously I'm saying this to Joey, who's never aged out of the zeitgeist and still inspires generations of kids. But for like a lot of people, there comes a time where you have to just be like, I don't have the energy to build or to do what it's going to be taken to save this scene or to carry it on right now because of what else have happened in my life. That's why I think Joey, your energy is so crazy to me, because you also have a real job affecting real change in politics and like,
Perfect.
You know, yeah. Like it's just, but it's like, I find it exhausting just raising three kids, trying to manage my ego as the lead singer in a band. I couldn't imagine also trying to affect positive change in the world too.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, I've got like three jobs. I'm in DOA, I'm a city councilor, and I'm running a small record label. So, I'm a little busy, but, the fun thing for me, I won't go on too long. One thing about politics is that always talk about changing things, but now I'm inside the system. I am changing things. I believe for the better. Right. So it's a funny thing, but it does take a lot of time and energy. Right. So, but I'm all good with that. Like it seems to be, you know, who I really idolize is that Pete Seeger. And I played with him a couple of times, like a total hero to me. And this guy got shut down. One of the most popular singers in the world, the American anti-communist McCarthyism, shut him down. But he didn't care. He made videos show people how to play folk music, how to play banjo, how to write songs. And he played on picket lines, and he just kept playing until he was like 92. Like it was like unbelievable, right? So to me, like if Pete Seeger can do that, if I can do 10% of what Pete Seeger did, then I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah. I 100%. I feel that exactly as well. And that like, it's an inspiration, you know? And I think, you know, and also Duff, I've always wondered, because I find like, and there's a great essay in this compilation that came out years ago called Some Ideas Are Poisonous, about how punk rock and this sort of ethos, and particularly hardcore, is like ingrained in us in a way religion would be ingrained in people in other ways. Like, so this is something you carry with you your whole life. And so at the heights of stuff that you got with, where you're in the craziest, biggest rock band of all time, arguably, was there parts of you where you're like, this is so, not bullshit, but like, just so counter to your foundational education in music? Because it's like, even though the band is informed by punk rock, the places you went is like the complete opposite of where you're coming from in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, at some point when it got massive, and I was lost, make no mistake about it. I was a lost soul swimming in that. I was in a wet cardboard box. I couldn't quite punch my way out of. I was addicted. And then I started having this, like I called it punk rock guilt, you know, like my band's too big, you know, like we're too, like, how do I find myself again in this, and really the punk rock guilt stemmed from. It was more about, I was addicted to alcohol and drugs, you know, and that it wasn't the band being big. That happens to a band when a lot of people buy into the thing that the truth that you're telling. And a lot, I mean, that was a freak thing that happened to Guns N' Roses, or whatever you want to call it. We just got huge, and it spoke to people around the world. That's beautiful. You should be like thinking, okay, you know, telling the stories of the truth, Mr. Brownstone, like all this stuff, and people are buying into it, identify with that. That should be super punk rock, you know, like spreading the word. But I think I had punk rock guilt, not because of my band getting big. I figured this all out later when I got sober and stuff. It was because I'd let myself down by getting addicted and all that stuff. And that's not very punk rock. You know, the time that I came up with punk rock, it was about, Joey said it was about helping others out, being kind, being cool, showing the light, you know, let's go. And I wasn't able to do that for a few years.
One of the most interesting parts of your book to me is that where you're telling the story of the altercation you guys had with Nirvana backstage of that show. And then Kim calls you the next day from the Fastbacks and just lays into you. And you're just saying how you kind of like looked at it differently after that. I don't want to misquote you or paraphrase you to yourself, but like, I found that was like, talk about punk rock guilt. There was like this sort of interesting moment that you're having to deal with as this guy that's like in two worlds or from one world and in another world.
I guess, you know, that was just a goofy, you know, I look back, it was so goofy. It was just a goofy moment that happened. But it happened to be in this really big public place, the MTV, you know, Music Awards. It's embarrassing, you know, all of it, but both sides, you know, like there is no sides. I mean, you know, of course, Novus Elk and I, colleagues at the Seattle Weekly and Grohl, you know, Scott and played with Guns a bunch of times.
Oh, absolutely. And I only bring it up because once again, Chris actually in an interview said that he sold all his rock records to go and see DOA. So DOA is a key band, I think, for Nirvana too.
Wow.
But I only bring it up because punk rock guilt is real. And I think, not to bring up friends that have passed away, but like my friends that have dealt with it, it's almost like, it sounds so ridiculous because it's just fucking music and what does it fucking matter? But it's also like a religious level of guilt where you betray this thing that's so important to you, that's so foundational to you. And not even that you actually betray anything, but you have this perception that you're betraying it. And not to put this on Kurt Cobain, but it's come up on this podcast a lot that here's a guy who was dealing with unbelievable punk rock guilt, and whether or not the self-medication, how that played into that decision. But because of the drugs, because of the alcohol, because of whatever, a lot of people, I think, are pushed to a weird place because of the guilt they feel about this music. And I know it seems silly because, like, we wouldn't be talking about ska guilt or swing music guilt in the same way, but this music is so different. Like it's so, you're carrying these giants like Joey or Ian MacKay or, you know, like anyone on your shoulders at any given time, you're carrying this culture. So I know what you're saying. Like, believe me, the heights that Fucked Up were reached are like nowhere near Guns N' Roses, but like I can't even say it. But at the same time, I dealt with this fucking punk rock guilt because I felt like my peers were not judging me. Like it's like such a strong, weird emotion that I think only people that are involved in punk can kind of wrestle with. And
yeah,
Joey, do you ever find yourself grappling with punk rock guilt? Because you guys are not a band that ever, I don't know, like you never really dance with major labels in any sort of major way, major, you know, maybe CD Presents regrets dealing with them, but they're not really, that's not really on you guys. Like, I wonder if you ever dealt with that sort of maybe in the politics world or anything.
Well, not really with the band per se. I mean, cause it's like, you know, put it this way, like, you know, the people you meet in bands, and Duff's like that they had this list, but usually they're just super friendly and they want to help people. And you know, that Duff ended up in one, if not the biggest one of the biggest bands in the world, that still, but he hasn't forgotten where he came from. And it's like, it's always like a matter, like when you meet people at shows, like I just like hanging out at the merch booth, talking to people, having a beer with somebody or whatever, you know, doing like, you know, it's like these people come down the show, they're excited. So I don't get the, any kind of guilt from that. Cause I think it's a matter of like staying connected with the people and remembering where you're from. With politics, it's that too, because I feel that what happens with politicians, they all start as small town politicians like I am, like a counselor or mayor or whatever. Then they try and work their way up the ladder. They think they're going to be fucking president or prime minister or something, right? And what they do then, three quarters of them forget where they came from. And I think it's really essential that you remember, oh, yeah, yeah, this is like we were broken down. And these guys put us up at their house for 3 days. We ate them out of house and home. You know, like this guy in Chicago, we had one show. And the guy goes, when's your next show? Well, it's not in New York for 6 days. And finally, so it 4 days later, the guy had no food left, right? But he was still like, thanks for Sam. It's great to meet you guys. Probably time to go to New York now, right? You know what I mean? I'm still friends with the guy. I mean, just like, so, like I said, it comes back to that punk being like, you know, like a kind and helpful thing. Not everybody in it. We touched upon skinheads, and you know, but I say like when you stay connected to your roots, then I don't feel this punk rock guilt. Yeah. Maybe I should. I don't know.
No. I have you of all people know. I discovered once I got sober and got into like martial arts, which is like the martial art I got into, it was very much like punk rock. It's just being honest with yourself, being honest with others, you know, keeping your side of the street, you know, as cool as you can, you know?
Yeah.
And that I'm like the punk rock guilt that I had, whatever you want to call that, quote unquote, punk rock guilt. I realized at that point, it wasn't because my band had gotten popular. It was because I let down like my punk rock ethos, you know, with letting drugs and alcohol get in the way of all that. That's all that was.
Yeah, but like it's Craig Ferguson, you know, famous Scottish comedian, was on this podcast, yeah, and talked about having a moment of crazy story. He actually drummed for Nico from the Velvet Underground, our last tour of Scotland way back when. But
yeah,
he talked about having punk rock guilt at a certain point where he was like this massive comedian selling out stadiums and just being like, did I betray who I was as this punk rock drummer in Scotland by doing this? Have I been honest to it? And it's weird how there's no other sort of music in this world where we carry a burden like it around with us for our whole lives, where like it is so much more than just a sonic. It's a culture. Like that's what it really comes down to. And it's a culture that goes back to, yeah, like, you know, not to keep blowing smoke up your ass, Joey, but like goes back to you guys and like, yeah, you know, and Desperate Bicycles in England, I feel, is another key band that was telling kids that were listening to this stuff. Like you said, Pete Seeger did. Here's how you do it. Go do it. And let's make a culture. Let's make a scene.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, say with Dup and Guns N' Roses, to me, there's like, well, you know, like, that's getting popular. That's one of the things you try to do in music, right?
Yeah.
The idea, let's get some people, let's sell some records, right? Like, this is one of the goals, right? You know, it's all good with me, right? You know, and like any logical person will come back to, and the caring person will come back and remember where they came from, right? So, you know, you might lose it for a while, but whatever. I mean, a good person will come back to that.
Yeah, like if it wasn't for Guns N' Roses doing what you guys did, I would not be sitting here talking to both of you. You need bands to go supernova to attract the kids for the next generation. And not all the kids are going to stick around. Not all the kids are going to get into punk rock. Certainly not every kid I met who liked Guns N' Roses got into punk rock. But a lot of the kids I know from punk rock got first introduced to it from, oh, you guys are doing a Rock from the Tombs cover on the Spaghetti Incident. My mom wouldn't let me buy it because of the Manson cover, though. That was like, I had to sneak into the house later on. That was the first Guns N' Roses record she really put her foot down on, to be honest, but I snuck it in the house. But that's the first place I heard about the Dead Boys, let alone Rock from the Tombs, years later when I realized that's where that song actually came from.
Yeah.
And without you guys doing that, quote unquote, you know, I don't think you can really say it's selling out what happened with Guns N' Roses, but like going supernova like you did, yeah, like you need these kids like to get into this stuff, and you need those bands to kind of do that. It's part of the life cycle, and that's how we keep this thing going, because otherwise it's just going to die out with the same people getting to enjoy it.
Yeah, and I don't feel, you said something about the burden of punk rock, and I feel the complete opposite. I feel so like I had this gift that came to me, and I was in the right city at the right age, and to get the message and really understand and be around cool people like Kurt Block and Kim Warnick, my mentors, you know, who made mixtapes, you know, for me, of, you know, the best mixtapes, and like Everything's Okay, you know, we you know, your band, you can open for us tonight. Really? We just formed last week. That's fine. Let's go. You know, and getting to see DOA numerous times, getting to see The Clash before London Calling, you know, with 150 people there, and you know, 999 and The Jam.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I could go down a whole list of the greatest bands I got to see. Oh, and a lot of times we had this $1 concert series in Seattle. Some promoter, you know, put these $1 concerts on at the Paramount, and anybody could go, you know,
wow,
get a dollar, you know, and that's where I saw Iggy, and that's where, you know, it's just like The Jam and 999 together for a dollar.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And I just saw 999 at Punk Rock Bowling like a couple months ago, and talk about one of the greatest live experiences I've ever had.
Wow.
Nick Cash is like Andrew WK positivity, but for real. Like, he was so awesome. And like, talk about a proto-punk. I bust out this single, Kilburn and the High Roads, which he played guitar on, and got him to sign it for my dad because it's one of my dad's favorite bands. But that, you know, Ian Dury's band before he did Ian Dury and the Blockheads. So here's a guy going back to like 75 and still involved in this music and still preaching about how anyone in the crowd can do it. And like, it's
not great.
Yeah, it's so great. Like, here, we played a festival the other day in Manchester where my band was the oldest band there by 10 years. And so here's this scene where there's people from 74 that are still able to do it, and people from in 2024 starting bands that are still.
Well, when you go to one of my favorite festivals is Rebellion.
Yes.
And Blackpool is like eight venues. And I'm. And they're all close together, so it's a really convenient vessel. And I look at these old English guys, and they're happy. They've got these summer teeth, some are here, some are there. They've got tattoos like everywhere, and they're 75 years old. And I'm like, wow, I don't feel so old tonight, right? So I'm glad I came here to hang out. But it's just like, yeah, people are still taking a lot of joy out of this, right? And amazing, right? So, you know.
Well, it's the only thing that you can kind of do where you're like, you're able to do it just because you love it. Like, so much of music is goal oriented. Like, oh, we got to do this to get to the next stage. We got to do this. And there's like a lot of people that do music because they love it and they're in their practice spaces. But this is a place where you can do it because you love it. And there's an audience. It might be 25 people in my case, but it might be 50,000 in Duff's case. You know, like, it could be any number of crowd, but there's still like validity in what we're all doing. And
you know, the cool thing about playing a gig to 25 or to, as you say, 50,000, I don't know, age or whatever it's been for me, just experience. I realize, you know, I've met so many people, I travel, and I'm sure you guys are the same way, because this is what you've been doing. And you observe other cultures. I'm a history nerd. I read so many history books. So I read history about the places I go to. And I go out, I go to museums and coffee shops and you name it. I go to like some weird heavy metal, you know, clothing store in Brno, Czech Republic, you know, let's check it out. But you meet people and you realize everybody's got a story, you know.
Yeah.
This person saved somebody's life yesterday. You know, this person went through cancer and beat it, you know. This person, there's always a story. And then I look at the people we play to, whether it be 25 or 50,000, everybody's got a story. And they all spent their time to come and see you play.
Yeah.
And spend the money to get a ticket or whatever, you know, got a babysitter nowadays, whatever they did. And everybody's got a story. And to take that energy in, you know, is such an honor, I feel, these days. Like, you know, I see it. I look out and I look at people. I'm like, wonder what their story is. They got a story, you know.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, not to be presumptuous, but it's what allowed me as someone who plays to 25 people to walk up to you who plays to 50,000 people and know that we're both peers. You know, like there's not so much in our world is like hierarchy and like, you know, like knowing your place. But we're two guys that obviously generations and geographically a country apart, we're told by Joey Shithead that we can go and do this. And
yeah,
here we're doing it and on different levels, but we're punks and we're hardcore kids for life. And that's something so great about this thing is that we're all like still in this fucking muck together with, you know, whatever new kids are also finding it. You know?
Hey, I got to co-sing a song with Joey Shithead over the last couple of months.
That was great.
It's on a 7-inch single that's coming out. I think I'm starting in Boston. I think it's going to be available. I can't wait. I haven't seen it yet. I just saw I saw a picture of the pink vinyl pressing. There's not enough time to get a test pressing. It's like, okay, I hope it sounds good. You know?
Yes. Well, then if not, then the first press will have like an interesting master job, but I'm sure it's going to sound amazing. It looks incredible. I'm going to do a plug at the beginning of this episode and tell people where they can order it and everything like that. And put a link in the description as well, because like, yeah, like, I don't know. I love that you're doing this and you're doing stuff with Leaving and you're, it's like just this continuum and just like I feel like giving respect and light to the people that inspired you, because you inspired me and obviously Joey eventually started inspiring me afterwards, but like it's important that these people know where these bands came from and that it's still important to them where they came from.
It's just a cool gig. It's just a cool gig. Yeah.
Talking about records, say, hey, Duff, I'm going to mail you a few of these today. This one, the DOA tribute album finally came out.
Oh,
as you know.
Yeah.
Duff's got two tracks on this. He covers Rich Spitz and The Prisoner, and they're both fucking great, right? So so we're really, really happy about it. I spent the entire week here building mailer boxes full of LPs shipping around the world, right? So, yeah. Like I said, I run a little label, and I have no assistant, so... I'm the president, the stock boy, the shipper, and everything.
Well, I was going to ask Duff, and now that you're on the record, were those at, like Living Vicariously through you on this being on this record? Because I was not asked. I need to bring it to myself always. But were those your first picks in terms of DOA songs?
Okay, so when I did Rich Bitch, this was like 2012, and Jimmy Joe from Toxic Reasons, who lives in Indianapolis now, drives a truck, and he was putting together this DOA tribute record. I don't know, Joey, if you knew about this or not.
Yeah, and he told me. Yeah,
right. So and the song by the time it got to me was what was left was Rich Bitch. I'm like, okay. So I played drums. I just recorded everything, and I got this guy, the Ice Wizard, to play this really ridiculous lead on it. That's awesome. The Ice Wizard, he's from Alaska, and he's this guitar player, plays a flying V. He's the best thing in the world, long blonde hair. So we did Rich Bitch, and then Jimmy Joe, that never saw the light of day. So come forward now to like currently, and they're making this tribute record for DOA, and Prisoner was available. That's of course always the first choice, right? If you're me, because I had the single, you know, like I'm like, the Prisoner, it's available. Oh my God. So I think Kurt and I did it. Or Block and I did it.
That's awesome.
So yeah, really good. And then I told Joey, you know, I said, you know, I do have Rich Bitch from like 10 years ago that I did, or 12 years ago. So they liked that one too. So I got two cuts, man.
It's wild. It's wild looking at this record. And I think it speaks to the power of DOA is your jump from Kiss to DOA was not jump, but like the kind of like loving both, but like, you know, moving that direction was Guns N' Roses to Propagandhi for me. And here you both are on the same record. That to me is perfect about how you guys link all this shit together. And
Killer.
I want to talk to you both forever, but I will let you mercifully carry on with your lives.
Right.
You guys want to come back. Yeah. You guys want to come back for a fifth time on this show together or separately. The door is always open.
And I'll see you, Joey, in Portland.
Yeah. The November 18th and 20th, Portland, Seattle.
We're going to sing the song together, right?
My name is Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, I better keep rehearsing. I'll have it.
I'm only rehearsing the lines that I sing.
Okay. Brian is going to send me the cut again, but I'll get on top.
Okay.
I'll make sure I'm ready.
Yeah. I know exactly where you sing because it's where I don't sing.
Okay. Okay. I better get this together, right?
Right.
Saving money on appliances now at Menards. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Whirlpool, Maytag, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on all appliances at Menards and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all our great deals. Save big money.